Alton Brown. This is the Alton Brown cast. This week, recording from a top secret location. somewhere in the Bay Area, that would be San Francisco, California, in the personal, private, well-guarded and booby-trapped workshop of Adam Savage.
How are you?
I'm good. I like this place a lot.
Yeah.
I kind of want one.
It's my sanctum.
A lot of us have a sanctum. You've got an inner secret sanctum. Do me a favor and tell people basically what you do here.
All right. So this is I live in a neighborhood that's sort of like the Williamsburg of San Francisco. This is the Mission District. And my wife and I have lived in and around the Mission District for actually more than 20 years. And when we moved into this most recent house, it's too small for me to put a shop in. And I like to live with my shop because if it's elsewhere, I never go there.
Right.
And I know myself enough to know that. So I thought, okay, well, I'll give up a shop for a while and then we'll see what happens. And then my wife said, you know, we're in an industrial area where there's a lot of old auto shops and stuff like that nearby. Why don't we go look for a shop? We can afford it. Let's rent you a shop. And let's make
mostly
a radius.
She just didn't want you to do this in the house. That's
very,
what's really going
very
on
very much so.
Yeah, it looks like a beautiful gesture. It's really self-preservation.
It's funny. You've seen my office in my house, too. It's like this light, right? Yeah. It's this, but tasteful and relaxing instead of... I love being overwhelmed by this space. And that's what I did. Two blocks from my house, we found this 2,500-square-foot formal marble cutting shop. With a loft space and a little office, and I built a shop, display place, meeting place. This is where we shoot our tested podcasts. I throw parties here. I had a fundraiser for my kid's school a couple weeks ago.
Wow.
And
nobody stole anything.
No. Well, you know what? I actually...
You have to lock some things.
I locked the cabinets because I don't know. I don't... You know, it's not like I don't trust people, but then you think through, wouldn't it suck if you had a party of a bunch of people who you like and stuff was missing?
Yeah, even just one thing, because
one thing.
Everybody's a suspect.
And you would just, your life would be, it would be awful to have to confront that reality. So this ended up being just this breathing space for me. So I come in here every morning, even for 10 minutes just before work.
And for those of you that haven't seen it on Tested, it's lined in beautiful glass cabinetry that are full of movie props, some of which you have acquired, many of which, having not been able to acquire, you have simply made.
I have.
By
the way, all these cabinets, they're all IKEA.
I know, but the little rope lights, the little LED lights inside make them look incredibly classy. This this thing about you and movie props, your whole life?
Actually, one of the first things I can remember making is a briefcase with a light-up board in it, like Mission Impossible, and a couple of switches and a couple of lights, and one of those switches and a button said detonate.
And we're talking about Mission Impossible. We're not talking about the movies.
We're talking about the original
Peter Graves show.
Martin Landau and
Barbara Baines and the whole gang.
It was so amazing.
Peter Loomis? The muscly guy. Peter Loomis?
Yeah. And he just passed away, didn't he?
Yeah.
That show was a quintessential example of the way no one, I think, would make television today, in that if you didn't watch it from the beginning, you weren't going to be able to pick it up what was going on. That show didn't wait for you.
No, you're right. And maybe that's one of the things that I liked about it so much. And a good bit of the time, at least when I was a kid, I didn't know really what was going on. But there's something incredibly intriguing about not being able to quite figure out all the time what was going on, which made me feel like I was just on the out, you know, that I wasn't cool enough to really know what was going on.
Well, yeah, my wife grew up, her father was British, and they would just go, they wouldn't look at movie times to go to the movies. They would just go to a theater in which the movie was playing, and they'd walk in. And they'd just start watching from whatever point they walked in. And when the movie ended, they would wait through the turnover. And then they would watch from the beginning to where they got to.
Well,
I know. But this is a distinctly British way of watching movies, it turns out. And in fact, it's one of Tarantino's early favorite ways to go see movies. And he states specifically in one interview that he says, I like to direct my movies for somebody who might walk in the middle and go, how did we get here? Watch to the end, and then when the beginning shows up around, you don't go, oh, that's how we got here. You still say, how did we get from where I am in the beginning to where I walked in the middle?
Well, this explains Reservoir Dogs, certainly,
and
a few other things, which I still think is his best movie. I mean, I've done it, but I never would think of doing it as a habit.
I know. I'm obsessively punctual. It comes from my mom, the Scandinavian punctuality.
Yeah.
And to me, I can't stand not seeing a movie from the very beginning, which is why I'm so happy that a lot of major cities now have movie theaters where you can choose your seats.
Yes.
That's the only way I go see the movie now.
is if you can actually pre-reserve a seat.
I did all my line waiting in my 20s. I don't want to wait online anymore.
Well, I don't want to, but I don't seem to have any option.
I paid for the TSA clear. I'm going to go do the pre-check. I frankly, everyone has to wait on lines in the airport, and that's fine. But you know, for movies and for breakfast, you know, like good breakfast joints where you're standing out for hours.
Yeah.
I'm just not interested in that anymore.
I was never interested in it. although I will say that not too long ago, it was in December. Was in London, and. One of my daughter's friend's family were also there, and we ended up getting stuck. They wanted to go to the Natural History Museum. The line was literally, it was an hour and 45 minutes online, and we ended up having the best time standing in line.
So
the line took on a culture of its own and actually turned out to be kind of like a cocktail party without any cocktails. That was the only thing actually missing, is we didn't have a cocktail.
Speaking
but it was still
that,
not a bad time.
You'll like this. At one of the Industrial Light and Magic Christmas parties, there was a bar that was painfully ill-managed. And we were online for the bar for about 40 minutes. It was ridiculous.
At a Christmas party?
At a Christmas party. And the line was so long, like you just said, it got its own culture. So about 8 or 10 people in front of us, we were a whole group just starting to talk, you know, got to know the people
party
around
within a party,
us.
A sub-party. Yeah. You were sub-party.
So about 8 to 10 people in front was the limit of our sphere of not knowing each other. And when 8 to 10 people in front of us got to the bar, the first thing they asked for was a dozen shots. And they just started passing them back through the line. And then the next people did it, and the next people did it, and the bartender just kept on pouring.
Just pour.
Yeah, because it was an open bar. And by the
what were the shots? I want to know what
tequila.
You're drinking tequila. The shot of shot, the mother of all shots.
Yeah, actually, right now I don't drink, but at Pied de Cochon in Montreal, the waiter sat down with my wife and I after the entree course with 3 shot glasses and a bottle of Bushmills, and I was like, Bushmills for shots. Really? I have to say, it was fantastic. I was a convert. I normally think of Bushmills as your backup scotch, right? It's like the one you have if you ran out of everything else.
If you ran out of all the good
stuff.
Yeah. But there's a difference between a sipping scotch and a shooting scotch,
yes.
Which is what we're talking about.
Totally. I mean, you wouldn't do that with Laphroaig or something like that.
No. I mean, you could, but it would be...
You'd be wasting everybody's time.
Yeah, everybody's time and a whole metric ton of money would probably be that. So why aren't you drinking right now?
Stress management.
Tell me about that.
Well, you know, when you're managing a bunch of different projects and you're at the center of them, no matter how well you've arranged it, no matter how well you are, how good you are at delegating, it's a stressful existence. You are thinking about the things all the time. You want them to be good. You want your imprint on them to be good. And then you have a family, and you have to take care of that family, and they have to take care of you. And it's often not enough hours in the day. So for me, over the last couple of years, I've been on a steady program of weight loss. I've gone from 195 to 168, and not drinking, which is great. You know, it's not like I had a problem with drinking. It's just that I don't like myself when I drink, and I don't modulate well when on alcohol.
Modulate.
Well, it's like I can't take any shift in what's happening. It's like if I'm having a good time and then all of a sudden there's a little tension, I don't manage it well at all on alcohol.
Okay.
And frankly, you know, family life is all about like little tensions here and there, and life is all about little tensions here and there. And also in my late 40s, waking up with a hangover,
oh, it sucks.
Not something I want to do anymore.
Sucks.
And they last for 3 days.
They can, yeah.
You know, they really get you.
Yeah.
And then the last one is meditating. We've been meditating a lot and just really trying to stay present. And those 3 things have been tremendous in allowing me to not take out my stress on anybody. That's been the big one, right? Like, you cannot take it out on your crew, and you might end up taking it out on your family. You might not take it out on your family. You might take it out on your crew, or your, you know, I might take it out on Jamie. The fact is, I don't want to take it out on anybody. Right. I want to be able to manage it. And if I am stressed, I can say I'm stressed and go take a bath and chill out and have a day of doing nothing. And frankly, we do a lot of that, as much as we can.
A day of doing
nothing.
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing. Like, not even coming here, sitting in the house, reading, cooking a meal, chilling out, watching a movie.
I don't have a memory of that. I have no memory of doing that. I guess I have. But I think that if I were to, I would somehow be guilt-ridden about it.
Though this is a problem I have, too. I always feel like I want to get something done by the end of the day. I actually begin every day with thinking, what can I get done today? And if I sleep until 11 and don't leave the house till 3, I feel like, I got to go get something done, man. This is terrible. But it's not. Like I don't have to get something done every day. And frankly, it's like, not enough time. My solution is spend more time with my family, and it's been fantastic. And watching movies. So my sons are 15, and it's really, really fun to inculcate them with an excellent movie training course.
And how is that going?
Really well.
I'm having a tough time with that one.
How come?
My daughter, I have yet to, incredibly intelligent young yeah. lady. I've had a very hard time kind of getting, and it's funny you mentioned this, I know a lot of dads with kids that have been trying to syndicate, give a cinema literacy
right.
To their kids, and all the fathers with boys have been having a much easier time of it than with girls.
Sure.
I can't seem to get my daughter to lock on to thematic information within a movie. The only thing that has cracked her in recent history, which has got nothing to do with me at all, is that she read all the Divergent books mm-hmm. and then dove into the kind of the culture
yeah.
of that and takes all these online tests, and she's like number 30 in the world now in Divergent trivia. I mean, so she's actually become yeah. obsessed.
Right.
But I haven't been able to find the right kind of entree, appetizer. I haven't been able to find the right appetizer of films to get her really to lock into the language of motion picture. She'll say she likes something.
Yeah.
You know, we'll watch Jaws together. We both like Jaws a lot. It's probably my favorite movie of all time.
So
I'll be
great.
Really honest. I adore Jaws. But, you know, she don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, we're not going to get any kind of deep stuff.
I just realized something about Jaws. Robert Shaw plays the Han Solo role in Jaws.
Yes.
He's the one making fun of the movie.
And Richard Dreyfuss is Princess Leia.
Oh, shit.
And Roy Scheider is Luke.
Wait, how sad is it that Gordon Willis passed away?
Yeah.
Man, what a terrible loss.
Well, what do you think Gordon Willis' best film was? If you had to pick one, if somebody came in here and said, who's Gordon Willis?
My initial thought is always going to be Godfather, but then I want to second guess that because I'm not sure I'm thinking of his whole canon at once.
Yeah, that's the easy.
It's the easy one. It is magnificent and mind-blowingly
definitive.
Lovely.
Definitive. Nothing had ever looked like it before and nothing had ever looked like it afterward, don't think.
No.
But then we could also say that about Jordan Cronenweth's work on Blade Runner.
Do you know when I showed my boys Godfather, this is about two, three years ago, so maybe 12 or 13.
And you thought they were old enough to see that kind of intensity?
Yeah, they had already watched some other stuff, that, like horror movies and stuff, so I figured they'd already fallen in love with movies like The Thing and with
the
Alien.
John Carpenter version, I hope.
John Carpenter, of course.
Oh, okay. Well,
the only one.
All right, good.
So Greedy. We're in the middle of Godfather. You'll love this. And my son, Thing One, says, right after Sonny dies, that's so sad. And they were really like, yeah, I heard them gasp, right? Because it's super graphic, more graphic than you expect the movie to be. And right after Sonny dies, Thing One says, well, it doesn't seem like the Corleones are winning. And I was like, oh, right. You think that the point of a movie is for the protagonist to win. What you need to understand is, no, that only happens most of the time, but there's a whole passel of great movies.
And this particular cycle is all about losing.
Right. And then then I stopped during Michael's speech about killing Sollozzo, the slow dolly.
It's the first dolly
first
move in the movie.
I know.
It's a great trivia question. You say, when's the first time the camera moves in The Godfather? I'm like, I don't know. It's like it's the emotional fulcrum of the movie.
It's shocking.
It is the moment that he crosses.
And I showed them and I talked to them about it, right? This is the camera's moving. This is what's happening. Michael is turning. And this is, I'm getting chills as I describe this. So,
because at that moment, he crosses a line that nobody else in the room will cross.
Right. Right.
That what-if moment of why can't you kill
and
a cop?
And showing
who says you can't
that
kill
he
a
has
cop?
What it takes to do it.
Or worse, he comes out of the larval stage
right.
into the full-blown purification of the Corleone.
Which is, of course, the undoing of Don Corleone, right?
He's doing
one thing he didn't want to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
So at the end
it's
of the movie.
It's the heartbreak of
So at the end of the movie, he says to Kay, this one time you can ask me about
this
my work.
One time.
And then he looks her in the eye, and he lies
to her.
And David Mamet says you can blackmail the audience into a standing ovation every day of the week, but you cannot blackmail them into a gasp. And both of these 12-year-olds went, oh, he just lied to her! And I was like, yes, that's the arc of this movie. Michael's undoing, Michael's darkness. This is, you know, Star Wars. It's fantastic.
It's Star Wars in reverse.
In reverse.
In a way.
Yeah. Or episode, right, episode.
Because there's no redemption. I mean,
apparently there's
no
some
redemption.
Other Star Wars movies in which that is the arc, but I can't remember what they are.
It doesn't matter. But it is the inverse.
Yeah.
It's funny, when I first showed my daughter Star Wars, which she did not like very much, because it looked so primitive to her. Even at, I think she was about seven probably, when I showed her, you know, episode 4. And she her overarching thing was she was terribly upset and worried about Darth Vader. She was very worried about him. And she's like, and it's funny, she even said, I don't know that he's all bad. Can't somebody see that maybe there's, maybe I'm, does, is he going to be okay?
Oh, that's awesome. That speaks
is
so well of your
okay?
daughter.
Is he going to be okay? And I thought, I said, well, all I'm going to tell you this is that ultimately this is his story.
Right.
This isn't Luke Skywalker's story. This is that guy's story, and maybe you'll see that sometime. But then she got sucked into Harry Potter world, and I lost her forever because special effects were so much better. You know, and
frankly, for a series of movies directed by what, four different directors over four or five. They're really terrifically consistent stylistically. I mean, they're not terrible movies. I think Harry Potter is not very interesting as a protagonist because all the films just happen to him. But then by that token, has anyone given you this, that in Raiders, Indiana Jones does not matter at all? In fact, if you pull him out of the movie, everything in the movie happens just as planned.
You take it back. You take it back. You just crossed a line.
I know. It killed me when I heard that.
Well, all right, no. Okay,
think about
okay,
it.
Okay. First off, who suggested this blasphemy?
I think that it was Will Smith from Tested told me that.
Have you played it? Have you played it through?
I have played it all the way through in my head, and I can't see that it's wrong. It's absolutely true.
Okay, wait.
Okay, Don't get me wrong. This has never left my top five. I consider Raiders a perfect film, and I wouldn't change a thing.
I don't know that it's as perfect as... I think there's one movie from the same generation that's more perfect. I think Back to the Future is actually more perfect as a crafted piece, if for no other reason, but then when the Nazi truck turns over, I can see the telephone pole, you know, blowout gag coming out of the bottom of it. It's my favorite. You know, if you said, I can either live Raiders Lost Ark or I can live Star Wars, I'm going to live Raiders Lost Ark.
100%.
I mean, it's you know, I had a whip when I was, the year that the movie came out, I got the whip, you know, and I wore a fedora and I learned how to use it. You still wear one because you look good in it and I don't. I'm just trying to think of all the things that he does in that movie. What does he actually do that makes something? I mean, the Ark never would have come out of the Well of the Souls. Do you think Belloc was going to find the Well of the Souls?
Well, that's the thing, though. Is that so either they wouldn't have found the Ark.
His stick was too
long. In which case,
they're digging in the wrong place.
Come on.
If he hadn't helped them find it, then it would have ended there. But he helped them find it, and then they were destroyed by it without his help.
Everything from them getting the Ark on... happens.
Yes.
He's got nothing to do with.
Right. He does affect the trajectory of the movie, but he doesn't affect the trajectory of the Nazis wanting to get the Ark. I mean, I guess they would.
No, but the Ark is its own undoing.
Yes. Yes.
He's from the moment that he decides not to blow it up.
Right.
He's a spectator. He's a spectator at that point. But would they have found it? I don't think they would have found it.
You don't think they would have found it? I suspect that they might have. I suspect that they would have just dug up everything. It just would have taken another couple of months.
All right. This is pretty distressing.
I know. I had the same thought. Take it back. I don't want to.
Yeah,
take
I don't.
This
I
thought.
Don't want. I don't want to live in a world where that's the truth.
No,
I don't. So what is it that draws you to that movie so much?
There's a seat of the pants thing to the way Indiana goes through his life that I really appreciate. He is So you've read Raymond Chandler.
Yes.
And within Raymond Chandler's canon, there's an essay called The Simple Art of Murder, which is his...
I haven't read The Simple Art. I have not read that.
Then I am jealous because you have a crazy treat ahead of you.
Fantastic.
And it is Chandler's analysis of what makes a detective story interesting from a stylistic and cultural point of view. Because when he decided to write, and Chandler didn't decide to write until he was 40.
Right.
When he decided to write, he knew only one thing, which is that he hated critical theory and he hated the standard American diegesis breakdown of literature, and he wanted to choose a distinctly American genre of literature that no one was paying attention to, and lighted upon pulp fiction and detective fiction specifically. So he, after several books, he wrote this essay that analyzes what makes the hero work, and he says, and this is towards the end of the essay, he says, in every form of art there is a sense of transcendence, and it may be comedy, it may be tragedy, it may be the raucous laughter of the strong man, but down these mean streets, he says, and this is where Scorsese got his title.
I did know that he had gotten that from Chandler, but I didn't know where it was from.
Down these mean streets, a man must go who is not himself mean and who is neither tarnished nor afraid. And then he goes on to tell you about this hero. He must be the best man in his world and a good enough man for any world. He has a range of awareness that startles you, but it belongs to him by right because it belongs to the world he lives in. About his sex life, I care little. He is not a eunuch nor a satyr. He might seduce a duchess, and I'm quite sure he would not spoil a virgin. If he is a man of honor in one thing, he is that in all things. And he is a proud man, and his pride is such as you will treat him as such, or he will deal with you with a due and dispassionate revenge.
And if I got nothing. I got no way to follow
and
that.
And if the world were full of men like him, it would be a very safe place to live in without being too boring to be worth living in. And I think of Indiana Jones as a perfect depiction of exactly that kind of hero. A man of honor in one thing who is a man of honor in all things. You know, I love Chinatown and I love Town Script, but Giddies is not Marlowe. He's much more tarnished than Marlowe is.
Oh, he's barely functioning ethical, moral standpoint.
Exactly.
I mean, JJ is not likable
no.
in any way, fashion, or form to me.
But I think of, you know, my wife and I, you must do this, the casting game of casting your favorite books as movies.
Sure.
Clive Owen as Marlowe.
The look, for sure.
The look and the...
And the kind of deep-seated kind of honor... And,
that deep-seated honor that he could be vulnerable without being weak.
Yes, that's a good call.
You know, Harrison Ford would have been amazing as Marlowe,
circa
1985.
Yeah. 1985, yeah, right around that time. I mean, don't you think that Deckard is Marlowe in a lot of ways?
Deckard absolutely is Marlowe. Absolutely.
You know?
100%. And they were totally writing to that.
Yeah.
They were completely writing to that.
But you very rarely hear anybody just say that.
No,
in analysis.
It's true.
But I can't think of at least in the 80s, I can't think of a Marlowe-esque character that nails that more than
than
Deckard does.
And I keep hearing that phrase, that feeling in me.
In me.
For her.
For her. Feelings. That horrible voiceover track. Oh my gosh.
I just found my special edition with all six cuts.
All the cuts.
And I've been lucky enough to see four of them in the theaters.
Which is your favorite?
I love the new Ridley Scott cut, the last one.
The very last
one. I really
one.
Love all the extra footage of them driving around and Harrison Ford looking around in the spinner. That stuff, you know.
It looks great, but is it really that great for story?
I feel like it is. I feel it makes it a much more slow and moody piece, which I feel the movie stretches in a way that it always could have stretched.
Right.
And feels like there's more breathing room. And I really like that. I was shocked the first time I saw it without voiceover how much hearing someone talk shuts your eyes off. Like,
oh,
as soon
sure.
as you're because watching those...
As soon as language is involved, you lock to the language.
I was amazed at that. It was an incredible lesson in how much you can, like, all of a sudden I'm seeing things in these cityscapes I'd never seen before. And I've seen Blade Runner in the theater at least, like, 10 times.
Yeah, me too.
I love that Scott cut. I also really love that what was called the first compromise cut.
Yes,
with the single line of voiceover after Batty dies.
After Batty dies.
I watched him die all night and he fought it as if it was something very precious to him, something kind of like that. I love that cut.
It was a good cut. It was shorter.
With all that scratch music and actual Ink Spot song.
Yeah. I don't know that I have that one on.
I think it's part of that.
Is that part of the big six?
I hope it is. I hope that it is. Because that's
it should be. Cause one,
I remember
two, three,
going to see that in, God, at this point, that would be 1993. 92, something
92,
like that.
92, I want to say.
That's when
that was the first cut from the original that was released in theaters.
Yeah,
that was the very first one.
At the Castro, just up the street.
And it was so much better to just getting the voiceover out was miraculous. And the ending, the bad, because the she lives part is gone from that one, if I remember correctly.
It is. That happy ending isn't part of that or any subsequent director's cut.
No. Nor should it ever have existed. The blasphemy.
All those extra
of
shots of Mount Hood from The Shining.
Gosh. You know who else might have been able to play Marlowe, I think? If it was early 80s, William Hurt.
Yeah.
Circa Body Heat.
Well, also you're thinking of Until the End of the World, which has a very...
You're right.
I wasn't
channeling it, but you're right. That was probably as close to that character.
So, you know, I have on DVD that I haven't watched, I have Wim Wenders' 6-hour cut of that movie.
Good luck.
The problem is it's region locked, and I've just never gotten around to paying $70 for a region-free DVD player. Yeah,
let me tell you this. I have seen 3 hours of it.
Oh, really? You have?
Yes, I have. I just don't do it. Don't pay the money.
I love that film.
Yeah.
That film presages so many technologies.
You want to keep loving it?
Don't watch the director's cut.
Not that one, no. It's a love letter to self. It loses... it's like Wim Wenders writing a love letter to Wim Wenders. I felt.
Okay.
Just in the 3 hours that I saw.
Okay.
But,
fascinating.
You know, if you do...
Yeah.
I don't know, I'd buy the... I don't know if that'd buy the box just to watch that, but...
Well, you know, I keep end up buying, because they're the best ones, buying Sony DVD players, and boy, those things are so hard to unlock.
Yeah, you can't lock them.
To make them region-free.
Yeah. My Blu-ray shut down. I mean, I still can't. I can't watch a Blu-ray on my den on there. It's the way it goes.
Lately, do you know what other movie's director's cut is absolutely abysmal? Is Donnie Darko.
You're right. That wasn't what I was going to say, but yeah, you're right.
I was shocked. Donnie Darko is so wonderfully enigmatic and bizarre.
Yes.
It's almost like a David Lynch movie.
Oh, do you think that movie could have even existed without David Lynch? I mean,
absolutely not. No, he's totally he totally braved the path for it.
Yeah, I mean, somebody was watching a lot of Eraserhead.
Before, but not the director's cut where they spell everything out and tell you what's happening.
No, I don't want to know. I don't need to know. This is one of those situations of walking in the theater at any point doesn't matter.
Right.
You know, it's still an enigma.
It reminds me that I love the fact that for the director's cut of Blood Simple, the Coen brothers made it 10 minutes shorter.
Shorter. Still my favorite of their films.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, I showed the boys Miller's Crossing recently.
Second favorite.
And I discovered something about Miller's Crossing. A theme that I haven't read about. The hat.
Oh, it's a movie. Don't you remember them saying we wanted to make a movie about guys in hats?
Okay, I haven't
seen that.
The Coen
brothers actually said that. We wanted to make a movie about guys wearing hats.
So he starts out with, he gave me the high hat.
Give me the high hat.
And then two or three different times, someone actually hands him his hat. Have his hat handed to him.
To him.
The literal thing is happening.
So many great shots.
The hat blowing in the breeze.
It's a movie about hats.
That hat blowing through the woods, I actually get annoyed watching it, thinking about having to make that happen as an effects guy.
And yet it works so well.
Right.
I've tried to look for the fan pattern and everything.
Right.
Because it's on dirt.
I know.
How is the dirt not?
I mean,
I don't know how to do that shot.
That's what I'm looking at. It's like, did they spray 77 all over the leaves and dirt?
Surely they didn't.
Did you also read, is it Sonnenfeld that shot that?
Yeah.
So Sonnenfeld in the DVD extra materials says, when the Coen brothers took him to that location, he said, this location will only work if it's cloudy. You better pray to God it's cloudy when we're shooting here. And he said
it always was.
It was cloudy except for one shot, which is the hat blowing away. And that was okay.
That one was okay. Well, he's using a much longer lens on that shot anyway. Yeah, was that the last film that he DP'd for them? No, because
I can't remember.
What did he do after that? He didn't shoot Hudsucker Proxy.
No, after that was Barton Fink.
Barton Fink, and I think Barton he did Fink. Shoot Barton Fink.
What's that?
I think Sonnenfeld did shoot that.
I don't remember.
But to me, maybe it's just because Blood Simple is one of those movies that once I saw it, life wasn't ever quite the same again.
Yeah,
for me.
Yeah,
there was something. I mean, sure, it's noir, but it's noir. It's funny noir.
Yeah.
Camera
going up over.
That rig. I mean, it knocked the life out of me seeing that. I know a lot of people go on and on about Raising Arizona, and that's fine and good. But
which is wonderful.
It's a wonderfully funny movie.
As a comedy, it's amazing. I love Hudsucker Proxy, and I love Fargo. But frankly, you know, that their whole thing of, well, we don't have to end the movie in a traditional way. No Country for Old Men enraged me so much.
Why?
Because the first two, three quarters are one of the best movies I've ever seen.
Oh,
the last quarter, wonderful. I hated them for killing my favorite character off screen as if he didn't matter. And I recognize, someone told me later, that there's a perspective shift about who's actually narrating the story in the book. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're actually doing filmically.
Yeah, but it didn't work.
I get that. But there's a reason Aristotle wrote out the rules of drama and why we want them.
Yeah.
You know, as my friend said, hey, Coen brothers, if you're the best guys in the world, how about this? Entertain me.
Give it a try.
Yeah, you might try that one.
Yeah, the sudden desire or the sudden need to kill off. Yeah, it's really hard to give a crap about that movie at that point, other than to really wonder who's going to give you your money back.
Yeah, that's exactly where I went with it. Yeah. I thought, oh, because there's nothing better than, you know, an unstoppable villain being met by an unlikely hero who might just have what it takes to defeat him. That is, I watched that story a million times.
Yeah, but not only does the villain not do the defeating, I mean, not only does the hero not survive, but the villain doesn't even do the defeating.
I know, he's killed by guys you haven't met yet.
Yeah, he's killed by insignificant.
It's just killed me. Made me so mad.
Yeah, I still...
But meanwhile, I think Fargo has a beautiful heart, and I love it, and I love Frances McDormand. I revere her and think she's amazingly awesome.
She's a fantastic actress.
We were... My wife and I were watching Laurel Canyon for like the third or fourth time, and mm-hmm. we decided to watch the DVD extras, and the DVD extras constantly talk about... Julia turns to me at one point. She's like, why do you think they're playing up how sexy Frances McDormand is in these extra materials? And I said, well, you have to realize that this comes out right after Fargo. And so the studio was freaking out about the idea of frumpy Marge being the sexy lead in this Nicole Hollis Center film. So they had to play that up. That's what they felt.
Choice.
Like. Yeah.
I mean, when you think about it. But... I even thought she was kind of sexy in Fargo, God help me. Because she's so willing to be... She's like the American Helen Mirren, you know, to me in a way. She's got that ability to... Because she doesn't seem to care about it, it makes her all the more appealing to me.
What's that? Smart is sexy.
Smart is sexy.
And, totally is.
And that, she's definitely got that.
The lovely relationship with the husband, you know, 4 a.m. I'll make you breakfast.
Yeah. Make your breakfast. This whole thing about his stamps, or his duck thing, his painting for the stamp is just so beautiful.
So, do you have images from films that like whenever I think Fargo, I think of that opening shot, mm-hmm. the fade into the snow cat, mm-hmm. and then I think of Steve Buscemi holding his bleeding face, going, "You should see the other guy."
You should see the other
guy, which is one of the great laugh drops I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's a hero. For me, I mean, it's the contrast. It's the chipper scene.
Yeah,
because it's from a cinematographic standpoint, the contrast of it and the angle from which it's shot is just, I don't know. It's a poetic thing for me. Jihadi and the chipper out there. The kind of lunacy of it, the utter stupidity of it is what makes it kind of beautiful. And the whole movie, though, the muted tones, you know, I would have loved to. I mean, that was shot on film and finished in an actual lab. So, you know, setting the timing lights on that would have been just a real hoot to get that compressed palette down.
Yeah.
That emotionally literally squashes you after a while in a movie like that. Oddly enough, almost the same color palette, I mean, same palette and same timing probably is used in Miller's Crossing.
Yes.
Which I just adore.
That the look and the feel and the pacing of that movie and that dialogue, everything about it, I absolutely love it. What's the rumpus?
What's the rumpus?
And frankly, you know, there are two kinds of people in the world, the Chandler people and Hammett people, and I'm Chandler through and through, and I think that Miller's Crossing is 10 times better than The Glass Key.
Yeah.
I mean, so much better. They find so much more interesting things about those characters to unlock and... I like him. He's sweet. He has a good heart. Well, then it's true what they say. Opposites attract.
But, you know, it's the language and it's the way that they all speak that makes that work so well, I think.
Yeah.
Breathtaking stuff. I didn't like the new one.
Llewellyn Davis. I haven't seen many of the recent ones.
I turned it on and made it about 20 minutes and decided I'd wander off and make toast or something.
Do you know what was terrific recently? We talked about this on Tested a couple weeks ago. The new Captain America film, Winter Soldier.
Saw it. Isn't that terrific? You know what? My associate, Jim Pace, sitting here on the side, massive Marvel fan. You're one of the only guys that I know that owns. You've got the shield. Who made the...
Yeah, you saw. I've got the shield over there, too.
You've got the battle-worn one. You had to get that in. We're not going to talk about where that came from. my feeling was I saw it, and I just thought, you know what? It was too big. I don't need 50 giant hovering battleships.
Right.
One would have been awesome enough without having.
Well, if you see that, there's that thing that Damon Lindelof says in an interview a couple of years ago, where he says the problem with the studios have is as soon as you're spending $200 million, the fate of the world has to be in the balance.
The entire
planet.
I would have been fine without that much stuff. I would rather just concentrate more on Nick Fury's car, you know.
But as a wonderful mood piece between them and the pacing of it, it's got a great heart. What's that?
Casting of Robert Redford is that guy beautiful. Because we all knew he was rotten from the moment he stepped on camera. I thought I liked it, and I'm not a fanboy, fanboy.
That was one of the early films I showed my boys when they were 8 or 9. We watched Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And do you know this, right? That when that movie was made, Paul Newman was the star, and Redford was the unknown.
Oh, he was just coming up.
Yeah,
I mean, he was not the star
Splendor
yet.
In the Grass, or so. No, that's Warren Beatty. But Newman actually fought to get Redford in that role. And then also they were much older than I thought they were. Like Newman's in his mid-30s, and Redford's like 31 or 32. Mm-hmm. You don't realize how much history happened before some of these things. Shows up so fully formed.
The fact of using modern language. Which in Goldman's script, it wasn't written as a period piece.
Yeah.
And if you just read it, if you just read the script, it could be yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
The soundtrack, Burt Bacharach doing the soundtrack, I mean, it's just...
Do you do that? Do you read movie scripts of movies that you like?
Yeah.
Isn't it cool?
I just find that, I want to see the interpretive material.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in some cases, it can just be a novel. I mean, if it's a Patty Chayefsky novel like Network or Altered States,
they're practically
those are
scripts.
Screenplays.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's no difference. There's literally no difference.
Like the Maltese Falcon.
Yes. Altered States is a really good example of that. If you see the film and you go back and read, you're like, all they had to do was highlight some lines here.
A few post-its.
Yeah, a couple of post-its. This is the shooting script. That's all that it is.
Did you... I hope you got to see the Kubrick exhibit.
Oh, I spent 6 hours over 2 visits.
That's about exactly my pacing, too. I did the
lenses.
Same thing.
Oh,
those lenses.
Oh, my gosh. Some of them. I mean, I would never think to just call somebody up and say, make me a lens. I need a lens. I need a 100-millimeter lens that will allow me at 2.8 to hold the front of the nose and the cheek in focus at 100 feet, for Barry Lyndon, is the only thing exciting about Barry Lyndon, perhaps. I would never think to do that.
Yeah.
When you
look at the original Mitchell that they put those lenses in, and you see the film plane and realized what it took for that machinist to actually move the film plane to accommodate those lenses from NASA.
Yep.
It's an amazing achievement. But out of that, they re-released the beautiful, massive coffee table book of Napoleon. The script with all the... I don't know if you've...
I've gone through the book. I do not own the book.
Yeah, I bought it, and I've gone through it a couple times. It's totally amazing. I love, like you, reading scripts. And I also love the way my favorite screenwriters editorialize in the script and talk about it. Vince Gilligan, I was lucky enough to get from him his script for Felina, the series finale for Breaking Bad.
He gave me my script of Raiders. Came from.
Oh, really?
Came from Vince. Yeah.
Did you? By the way, speaking of Raiders, have you seen that transcribed conversation between Spielberg, Lucas, and Kasdan?
No. I haven't. I've heard about it.
I'll send it to you
because you can't get it online anymore.
Okay, I've got a PDF. I'll send it to you. It's beautiful.
I would love to say, because I'm especially interested in what Kasdan has to say.
He is actually the quietest of the three.
Really?
What's the thing I found most surprising? So what's unsurprising is that Spielberg goes after every trope he can, and it's almost a pathology. But it's based on this, just again, like Tarantino, a deep knowledge of film.
Right.
Right. So he's throws out all of these wonderful sight gags
from Lash LaRue over here and
exactly exactly. But at one point, early on, they said, yeah, he needs a weapon, a sidearm, like a whip. And Spielberg goes, right, and at some point, he should use the whip to twirl and bring the girl to him. And Lucas says, uh-uh. if it's a weapon, he only uses it to harm people. He would never use it on the heroine. And I think to myself, wow, George is demonstrating some very fascinatingly deep knowledge about what the audience would and wouldn't want
to
see.
Let him get away with, yeah.
And where is that? Where did that go? Right? Like, you know, he said at one point after American Graffiti, it's easy to make the audience care about a character. All you have to do is twist a kitten's neck. And he's totally right.
There's I wouldn't have thought of it in those terms, but
right,
okay.
But, I mean, he's completely right. And so there's, you know, someone who can make a movie as sensitive and lovely as American Graffiti and understand things about characters like Indy. I don't know. Maybe it was Marsha. Maybe it was all Marsha's influence.
Well, I wouldn't downplay that necessarily.
No, not at all.
But somewhere in one of the Indiana Jones movies, he does use a whip.
He does. In fact, he does. And it's not in the first one.
Nope.
I think it's in the second one.
He uses it on Kate Capshaw.
Yeah. It's at the
very end of a movie that I don't think should have ever been made.
No.
I hate that movie.
Totally, totally, totally.
I don't know that there's one redeeming scene. There's not one scene in that movie I enjoy.
No. No, I can't stand Short Round. I can't stand all the effect sequences. I don't like the plane thing. I don't like Club Obi-Wan.
I don't like Club Obi-Wan
I
don't like anything.
My eyes out.
I got nothing for that.
No.
It was such a letdown because I was so looking forward to it when
it
came out.
Yeah, no, me too.
Because I'd seen Raiders. I know I'd seen Raiders 10 times in the theater.
I remember the summer Raiders came out with my cousin. And after Raiders, we went and saw Moonraker, right? A couple of weeks later. That summer was amazing.
It's a good
and
summer.
He goes, after Moonraker, he goes, well, that was the best movie this summer. And I'm like, are you an idiot? Because Raiders happened 2 weeks ago and nothing's bumping that one from the top of the list.
Nothing's going to take that. No, that was 82.
Mm-hmm. And if you look up the IMDb list of all the movies that came out in 82, which
amazing.
Is like The Thing, yeah. Empire's 80. At any rate, that list is a mind-blowing list.
Yeah, I want to say 82 and 84 were really big years. Blade Runner was
80,
and E.T. came out that same year.
Yes.
Those are the big summer movies.
E.T. came out that year, right.
And Poltergeist.
Close Encounters was 79.
79.
That's a great movie, too. Boy, that guy.
I like Close Encounters. It's not paced like any Steven Spielberg movie. It's more like he chugged a quart of David Lean's blood and then went and made that. And I think that a lot of that is Vilmos Zsigmond.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I remember about it. It's just all those beautiful shots, the planes coming out of the dust, all the hands sticking in the air.
It's a series of stills in a way. It's painterly.
Yeah.
It's David Lean to me. There's Lawrence of Arabia in
that. I hadn't thought of that, but you're totally right. It's got that epic scope.
If you look at the scope of his films
before,
I mean, especially if you're looking at Jaws, mm-hmm. you know, don't even go back to Sugarland Express or anything, but just Jaws, and then look after. It stands out. It's this weird, epic, slower pace. It's long.
It's================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================ all these strange characters you never quite get to understand. Truffaut and Bob Balaban, a phenomenal duo. All those reveals. Actually, that opening 10 minutes of the air traffic controller, you want to report a... That, I mean, that to me is one of those...
That, but you know whose voice that... You remember who played the air traffic controller?
Wait a second. I can't dredge it up. Who
if
is
you
it?
Listen to it now, it's Morgan Freeman.
No way!
I'm pretty sure that the air traffic controller is Morgan Freeman. We can look this up, of course. But if you listen to it, I'm pretty sure it's Morgan Freeman.
Wow.
Jim, get on that. IMDb, I don't even know if it's credited, but I'm pretty sure that the voice of the air traffic controller at the beginning of Close Encounters is Morgan Freeman. But the pacing and Truffaut just even being there.
Yeah.
You know, how many people that are going to hear this even know who we're talking about? And it doesn't matter. But Spielberg yeah. must have been in awe because he was a huge Truffaut fan.
Well, and there was a whole thing about those guys at that age when you read Easy Riders and Raging Bulls, that all those guys, and Landis also put all of his favorite directors and writers and DPs in his movies as bit characters.
Did he?
Yeah. If you go through, there's a wonderful monograph on Landis that shows a whole bunch of them, but he was constantly pulling his favorite people out of retirement to be in his
John
movies.
Landis.
Yeah.
Didn't realize that.
Yeah.
One of my favorite horror movies of all time, American Werewolf in London.
Oh, man.
I adore American Werewolf in London. It to this day stands up to me so beautifully.
And that actually was my friend and I were watching the end of Winter Soldier, mm-hmm. and he's like, we're both looking, and I went, it's Jenny Agutter. And he was like, ah, because we were trying to debate, is it what's her name from the Avengers? Emma Peel? Is it Diana Rigg?
Diana Rigg, no.
I thought Diana Rigg, and I was like, no, it's not Diana Rigg.
Jenny Agutter.
So who, and Jenny Agutter, I love her so much from...
She disappeared.
I know.
Disappeared. I thought that we were going to see a lot more of her after American Werewolf. She didn't. She disappeared into European films for a while.
It's Landis, I think, that whole thing he did of... He's so funny, mm-hmm. right? And so scary. And the funny made the scary worse.
Oh, doesn't it always?
Yeah. But I mean, you know, Tarantino's made a whole career out of that.
Out of funny, scary.
And using the fear to make your laughs more grateful, right?
You know, yeah, but I think that this is the inverse, though. This is using laughter to make the horror more terrible.
And playing with that juxtaposition. It's so interesting to me. I asked him about it, and he didn't talk about it as a grand plan that he had. Like, oh, I'm going to take these two things and join them together.
Just do it.
Yeah. I mean, he wrote that script when he was 18, for Christ's sake, which is annoying. Him and his friend, 18-year-old Rick Baker, talked about how to do the effects. And then I think he was 27 or 28 when they finally got the money to make Werewolf. And he called up Rick and he said, hey, so we can finally make that Werewolf movie. And Rick said,
I just did.
I know. I'm in the middle of production on The Howling.
He was making The Howling.
And he quit production on that to go work on Werewolf.
I don't think any of the transformations in The Howling, though, are as effective as that one.
No.
In American Werewolf. Because in American Werewolf, it is lit like a normal home.
Yeah.
This doesn't happen in a scary lighting. There's nothing frightening about the scene.
And it takes forever.
It's long.
3.5 minutes or something.
And it's the first time that a transformation, to my mind, compared to The Howling, which I'll still watch.
Yeah.
It looks painful.
Exactly. That was
this
the
is
modern...
not a fun thing to go through.
And
whereas
this is now
in The Howling,
that is standard that we think
is
of.
The pain. Yeah, the breaking of the bone. But in The Howling, it was always shrouded in darkness. Not a movie that's aged very well from a look standpoint, from a cinematographic standpoint. But there's a release of something like an addict, you know, getting a fix instead of something grueling, a grueling experience, which is what David Naughton is going through in that apartment.
And you know, they had planned to originally shoot it in one take. He had designed the animatronics to do it in a single take, but because that's how they were doing the Howling transitions, Landis was like, I don't want to go anywhere near our original plan since you've used half of it for this other
you
film.
Bastard.
You cheating bastard.
You bastard.
I want to do, so they did it as a series of cuts. And I got to visit Rick's studio earlier this year, and he was showing me the sculpt of the werewolf face and showing that that specific sculpt for the expanding nose.
That side shot, the profile shot of the nose,
is
the snout.
Sculpted two different sculpts because from here it's human, and then when it gets here it's wolfen, and it's made to do double duty for the camera.
Interesting. That movie, of course, soundtrack was so critical important, as it has been for all John Landis films, but that one.
You know who wouldn't give him a moon song for that movie?
No.
Cat Stevens wouldn't give him Moonshadow.
Really?
Yeah. And apparently said something like, you know, be careful about messing with the lycanthropes or something like that.
Cat Stevens said that.
Yeah.
That's funny because he probably meant it. Yeah. Don't screw around with the lycanthropes.
There's a couple of German guys on YouTube who've gone to all the original shooting locations in Scotland.
Really?
For Werewolf. And they've actually done a beautiful job of intercutting and matching the shots of the modern day and the old one, including the inside of the bar, which is actually the inside of that bar. The Slaughtered Lamb.
The Slaughtered Lamb, of course. Stay clear of the moor.
It's so good.
Have you ever become so fanatical about one? I mean, let's face it. A couple of German guys so fanatical about a movie that most people would now say is obscure. I mean, most
strangely, yeah.
It doesn't show that much. Yeah. You know, it's not seen that often. It's not one of those things that you stumble. It's not the Hunt for Red October, for God's
right,
sakes.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I mean, you literally has its own channel, you know, but a couple of guys decide to do something that obsessive. I mean, that's obsessive.
Yeah.
That takes time.
Yeah.
That takes money. That takes crazy amounts of effort. Have you ever felt yourself to be that fanatical about one thing? One thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm a serial fanaticist.
Well, you're a serial fanaticist. You're the Hannibal Lecter of this stuff, as I'm looking around your room. But if you had to pick, I mean, you'd have to pick like one film.
If I had
or
to pick one
thing,
film.
One thing that you could literally say, okay, this year I'm only going to fixate on something from this film.
Wow. Well, I mean, it's ended up being that this last 6 months has been really devoted to stuff from Hellboy. And I'm working on...
But he's your friend.
Yes.
Guillermo del Toro is your friend.
Yeah.
So, not that...
There's, you know... Do you mean it's like Desert Island if I had to choose one thing?
Well, I'm just saying, have you ever found yourself... this isn't a hypothetical. I guess what I'm asking you is, has there been a point where you found yourself fixating on something or obsessing on something to that degree where you're willing to put that much effort and that much time into a specific project? Like these guys want to make location photos that they took into a movie.
I'll tell you that when I get obsessed with a prop, I don't only go into just the prop replication. I also end up wanting to continue the feeling of being fully absorbed by the project. So, for instance, for this Hellboy prop I'm replicating, I'm also making a in German mid-century manual for it that would have been built by the guys that built it. And I'm also making a poster of its construction so that if you bought this poster and you had some building skills, you could replicate it completely from scratch based on this single sheet poster. Which is itself a massive graphic project.
A massive project.
That's the kind of meditation. So for me, it's frankly what I've realized of late is that I hate finishing projects. I don't like wrapping them up. And so I need artificial deadlines to wrap them up. But I've learned about myself that left without a deadline, I will tend to leave things unfinished because there's something that makes me feel sad about letting a project go. So I end up looking for other things within the project to start to build and do from them.
When the Kubrick show at LACMO was open, and I was here shooting... So I was here shooting Food Network Star, and I went twice and obsessed. And of course, they were selling the new. It was a new Blu-ray collection.
Yeah.
That I think is everything, but I want to say Paths of Glory is not in it. But no, Paths of Glory, I think it is in it. Blu-rays of everything, and I basically had a 3-day weekend, did nothing.
Wow.
But watch everything over and over.
The transfers are great.
Sequence.
The transfers are all great.
Are amazing.
Okay.
Especially 2001 and The Shining.
We just watched The Shining a few months ago.
Especially good. And the behind-the-scenes footage.
Of his daughters. His daughters' footage from behind-the-scenes of The Shining. I've watched it like 3 times.
I loved it. For some reason, I'm utterly... watching... It's the scene in the lockup in the dry storage where
Kubrick's shooting on the RE2C.
He's got a 2C laying on the floor with a wooden... floor plate with an Edison bulb.
I know,
a standard light bulb.
A bare, like, 150 watt bulb with a little bit of opal on it.
With a little bit of opal. It's got a little diffusion on it. Opal's a kind of diffusion. And he's talking to Jack and saying, hey, can you try to look this way without making... And then they cut it into the scene.
I know.
And it's like getting smacked in the face.
I can't get enough of watching that. Watching how unbelievably charming Jack is.
Yeah.
Flirting with... everyone, when he flirts with the script lady, this large Latina woman, and he goes, maybe we could go over these lines later on in my room.
My room.
And she starts to smile, and he goes, I'm not saying anything will happen. It's just a place to start talking.
It's a place to start talking. And yet, you, with just a twist of a knob, you hear that voice saying, give me the bat, Wendy.
And when he's working himself up in the bedroom to go through the axe.
He's doing this.
Yeah.
You know, he's doing this. And then they cut it into, here's Johnny. It's very, very visceral. I got the idea that I wanted to go and take Eleanor Coppola's documentary,
Hearts of Darkness,
and intercut it.
Oh, yeah.
Into Apocalypse Now.
Right. That would be a beautiful thing to do, to watch how those... You know what I've always wanted to see, though, is the shots of Keitel as Willard.
Have you seen any of them? Where are they? You know they exist.
I don't think cartel will let them out. I'm pretty sure that's the reason. It, currently, you need the acquiescence of the actor.
Of the actor.
And the only reason you wouldn't see him is because of him. And but there's a shot in that behind-the-scenes stuff where they're walking with Kubrick through this labyrinth to the set of the labyrinth.
Right.
But you're walking through all these flats, you know, like we know the backside of the woods of all the, you know, the artifice and everything. And I'm watching it with my son, Thing One, and he turns a corner, and now you're in the lit set of the labyrinth at night in snow. And my son goes, whoa!
And you realize that it's all salt. It's not snow, it's salt. Oh my God.
Salt and soap.
Yeah, and
salt soap. Salt and soap flakes.
This whole idea that he lit everything. Everything. And then sent everyone away and shot the movie with 12 people.
Yeah.
They just flip on the lights. You're going to shoot in the ballroom? Flip on the lights.
Amazing.
It was all just there.
That
nothing
I did
is
not
ever.
Realize.
Yeah. It's all in the new
right.
DVD
because they
stuff.
Go back behind the ballroom.
It's all. He came in, you know, the big lights outside the great room.
Yeah.
The big room where he types. I forget how many thousands of watts of power is out there. And then they left it for a year. He could move around and shoot anywhere he wanted simply by turning the lights on and off.
Amazing.
And basically shot the movie with a crew of about 12.
You know,
which is why they all felt so lonely and isolated actually while they were doing it.
Yeah. Well, Shelley Duvall was practically unhinged by making that.
Oh, she almost went insane because, and that was Kubrick that did that to her.
Yeah. Isolating her.
He was a monster to her.
Telling the other people not to talk to her.
That was a mind screw that he did to her.
So a young John Landis ended up meeting Stanley Kubrick around the time of The Shining. And in fact, John also got that first reel of Garrett Brown's Steadicam
reel. World. Yeah.
And there is one Steadicam shot in American Werewolf in London that might be the first or second time it was.
It's on the escalator.
No,
in the subway station,
no,
isn't it?
It's running through the woods for the dream sequence. That was shot by the only other guy who could operate a Steadicam at the time because Brown was shooting The Shining. So John said that Stanley would call him up from time to time. You know, like all sorts of people were on Stanley's phone list, and he would call and talk for hours every night on the phone to different people. And Landis was on that list for a while.
How do you think he got there? Because that's not a natural.
They were introduced by an agent in London because they were both shooting in London at the time.
Okay.
And as a filmmaker, Stanley was interested in John's approach. But John said that one of the things that all Stanley wanted to talk about was saving money on the set. Tell me, John, do you own your own honey wagons for craft services? No. And he goes, you really should. I make so much extra money for my shoot that I can put back into the production. And then all these ways in which he sculpted the insurance riders to get extra days of shooting. So he'd have on the list 42 days of shooting, but he would already know the ways in which he was going to game his insurance riders to get 120 days of shooting out of this 45-day shoot, all on the insurance policy.
Well, I've talked to several people that say he was more producer than anything else.
Right.
More producer certainly than writer, more producer even than director. That's where the real art of getting those movies made was as a producer, which makes sense when you look at them.
When you think about the amount of time he would spend getting something right. I mean, I heard that Scatman Crothers was brought to tears by 100 takes.
The axe scene, supposedly. No, the most number...
That was
I got this. It's actually the conversation, the chocolate ice cream conversation with Danny. It's the most takes.
Yeah.
In like the history of cinema.
And he's not asking for anything. No. He's just saying, let's do it again.
Yeah. Over and over.
You know, in my bathroom, I've got that pic. I've got the picture. I've got a really nice copy of the picture.
Nice. And yet that movie is still, you know, there's only one supernatural event in that movie. Imagine for a moment that everything that happens in that movie is from human madness.
Okay.
But
it's Danny seeing the twins. No.
That could be madness. That could be in your head.
Right, sure.
One actual physical event happens.
Or the unlocking of the freezer.
The unlocking of the freezer.
Right.
Or the dry storage.
Man, so we just watched it, like I said, about 8 months ago with my kids, and I had forgotten a couple of things. One, how absolutely weird the ending gets. Like when Shelley Duvall turns and there's like the people in costume.
Yeah.
On
the bed. Doing stuff that people didn't used to talk about before there was an internet.
But I also had in my mind, you know, you have a pace for the movie in your head and you think, okay, so this movie's going to pace this way.
Right.
Right. And I had remembered The Shining as being a little bit of a slow burner at the beginning. That movie runs right into insanity very quickly.
Yeah. To me, to this day, for some reason, the most unnerving scene in that movie to me.
Yeah.
Is near the beginning when Shelley Duvall is trying to explain to the doctor why and how Jack hurt Danny's arm. And remember, there's a female doctor that is, he's had an episode and it's still down in Boulder in their apartment.
Yeah,
this is the very beginning. Female doctor. And this is the doctor's smoking a cigarette, which I always find so lovely
in
these movies.
The 70s.
And simply sits and watches as Duvall tries to shuck and jive her way through explaining this event. And you realize everything that happens in the whole rest of the movie to me hinges on that, just that, which comes down to you are expecting you're lying. You're everything about the way you think your life is a lie, and everything's going to unravel.
And it's that way in which Kubrick was really able to find so many times in his scripts that place where you don't expect tension to exist.
No.
And then stretching it until you can't bear it.
It's a little expedition. It's just a little bit of nothing.
The second shot in Barry Lyndon in the duel.
In the duel. Right?
The idea that that it would happen, and the degree to which not dying is so much worse for him.
Yes. So much.
So much
worse. And the realization
that
it's so much.
What that tragedy is.
Yeah.
My father always said that whoever was in a Kubrick film gave their lifetime best performance in that film. And I'm not sure it applies universally, but I would say, you know, you've got George C. Scott, Kirk Douglas.
I wouldn't say Peter Sellers. Well,
no, Peter. But again, actually, Strangelove, Peter Sellers is mind-blowing in it.
He is, but I don't know that it's the best performance of his career. That's Chance the Gardener and being there, to my mind.
Totally. Totally, but except that as far as a tour de force of an actor, the difference between Mandrake, I think of Strangelove as the least interesting thing he does in that film. Mandrake and Merkin Muffley are amazing.
Or better.
And that, so also imagine this. I was watching this with the boys because they just watched Strangelove and loved it. But that scene in which he's talking to the
Yuri.
Well, he went a little funny in the head.
A little funny in the head. Now, Yuri, there's just no call. Yeah.
There's no cut. It's a single shot, and it's like 6 minutes or something of Peter Sellers doing something that is like Bob Newhart on steroids. And you imagine
it's 100% Bob Newhart. It's like the original monologues that he used to do of the phone calls.
Yeah,
that
yeah,
you can
exactly.
Still get here
exactly.
On records.
Abner,
that's
tell me
it.
About this game, baseball. Yeah. And Peter Sellers is doing it. It's Kubrick, right? What did he do that 20 times? Imagine sitting and doing that while the other actors are working and reacting to you. It's just camera sitting on you. You're doing this conversation.
Do you think that one of the things that Kubrick did was hire people that had not been stretched enough and then get the performance out of the life? I mean, Matthew Modine in Full Metal Jacket had not given a life-altering performance.
Well, no, it's true.
I mean,
so
Ryan O'Neill not given
a
life-changing performance, except maybe in Paper Moon, but that was... No, I'm not even going to say
but,
that.
But, I mean, that showed but, that...
That was that before?
A real character arc.
I was trying to think of Barry Lyndon was after Paper Moon.
Yeah, well, I mean, without a doubt, Barry Lyndon's Ryan O'Neill's best
of course.
Movie, 100%.
Yes.
But that arc of a character that Matthew Modine goes through in Full Metal Jacket is astonishing.
It is. It's a beautiful. It may not be quite tour de force, but I mean, would you say The Shining is Nicholson's best role?
No. So I'd say there's absolutely exceptions.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
But I mean, he did. So, this is what I was going to say. I met Peter Coyote a few months ago, and we started talking about Kubrick, and he was mentioning he had a long night of dining and talking to Malcolm McDowell about making Clockwork Orange. And he said Malcolm's theory on why the many takes. And Kubrick would always say things like, my actors can't remember their lines, that's why I have to do so many takes. That's what he said about Full Metal Jacket. Why did Arlie Ermey have only one single take? He's like, because he showed up knowing all his lines every day. McDowell's theory was Kubrick wants all the different takes so that he could cut any movie he wants. Because over 50 takes, an actor's going to try many different things. And it's well known that George C. Scott's all of his most outlandish takes were chosen for Strangelove, and he hates his performance in that film.
Because he thought it was too comic.
Unbelievably brilliant. But there's, you know, I think that has real meat to it as a theory. You know, he's going to get all these different tries, and he's going to be able to kind of boil this character in kind of whatever he wants.
He can cook it however he feels like cooking it
yeah.
in the edit.
Yeah. You know, that's a Hitchcockian view. They're cattle. I'm just going to keep pushing this button until I get a result that is interesting. And now when I get one interesting result, maybe I can get a second one.
Yeah, except Hitchcock was being motivated by a whole different set of
demons. Oh, yeah. My favorite ever Hollywood Squares joke of Paul Lynde's? The question is, Otto Preminger called them children. Hitchcock called them cattle. What are they? And, of course, the answer is actors.
Well, the likes of them will probably never exist again. There'll be no more Kubrick's. I mean, now that everything's CGI, I don't know.
You know, it's funny because when I worked on AI, and when we were making it, I had been following rumors of AI since 1991. Mm-hmm. And we made it at ILM in 2001. So to me, it was like, I finally get to work on a really major and important film that will be part of the film canon, right? Spielberg picks up the ball where Kubrick left off.
The ball from Kubrick, yeah.
And I watched AI recently, and it's much better than I remember, actually. It's a sweet movie with some genuinely devastating moments, and we did actually an unauthorized commentary on Tested.
About did you?
It. Yeah. Watch the whole thing.
I gotta
press
see
play.
It.
It's great. Wait, where was I going with that? Oh, right, was... When it came out, one of my main jobs on it was destroying all the buildings for New York. So there was a crew making buildings, and me and my crew, we were taking them and destroying them. And my best friend said to me when the movie came out, he was like, "You know what kills me is all of that time and money and all of that ingenuity. And the film is beautiful on a certain level, but it doesn't look half as good as Blade Runner, and it's 30 years older. Or at that point, it was 20 years older."
Yeah.
How is it possible that Blade Runner shot with in-camera passes? Well, that's the main thing. They're all in-camera passes. There's no maps. There's no composites. There's no... It's all just programming.
Yeah.
And all that depth you get from one piece of film. Can't be replicated.
There's something intrinsic.
Yeah.
And visceral that is not replaceable.
Yeah. I mean, it's totally true. And he was like, everyone should put their head in the sand that they can't make a movie as good looking as Blade Runner in the 35 years since.
Can you think of anybody that has?
You know, I will tell you that I think there are some standouts. As much as I hate the prequels, with the sound off, episodes 2 and 3 are absolutely beautiful and genuinely look like Doug Chang or Ralph McQuarrie paintings.
Which they must have been based on.
Right, and they really, really fulfill the promise of paintings, where the early Ralph McQuarrie paintings for Star Wars doesn't look anything like those.
No.
Strangely enough, the new version of Total Recall, while an absolutely abysmal movie, has some beautiful art direction to it, and it's totally inspired by Blade Runner, and sort of carries the Blade Runner world forward.
Well, there's definitely Sid Mead DNA in there.
Constantly, all over
constantly.
It. But... as far as a movie that looks that great, that's that immersive of a totally alternate reality, you know, I can't think of it off the top of my head. That gives you that much of a scope of a place that you feel you just get it. Yeah.
I don't have it. I don't have it. Los Angeles 2013, right?
2019. So we still have 5 years.
Maybe it's just because there's not that often in film history do you get the right production designer, the right cinematographer, the right director together at a time when, of course, that film stock was new. You know, we're dealing with some high
speed.
Was considered high speed stocks at the time. I mean, that wasn't 5290. Wasn't 5298, 5292, maybe it was. They were able to rate that at like 400. Nobody had been able to do that before. A film that was first used on a terrible movie called just left me.
Terrible movie that narrows it down.
Yeah, Willem Dafoe.
Platoon?
No, it was a gang.
Streets of Fire.
Streets of Fire was the first time that they had used that film.
Michael Perret and
Diane Lane.
From The Little Romance.
Yeah.
Do you know, I've been meaning to ask you, since you're a Steadicam op, have you seen these stabilizers, these motor stabilizers?
They're unbelievable.
They're unbelievable. I really feel like, I mean, so the, you know, last year Movi came out with a $15,000 stabilizer that is now is $5,000, and somebody else is coming out with one that's probably $4,000, and within a year there'll be a grand. Now the $4,000 one has a 17-pound payload.
Yeah.
That's a Red Epic with whatever lensing you want on
any
that
prime.
Puppy.
You can yeah. Buy anything but the really widest prime.
Yeah.
We'll go on there. You know, the thing that it's not going to be able to, you know, the nice thing about a Steadicam is the ability to isolate the camera mass away from you. You know, there's, it's, and,
right.
And there's something about the finessing of it that it's not just a matter of stabilization or isolating vibration or anything like that. It's the momentum of turning it on its own axis. You still get a feeling of weight.
But what I imagine is that it's only a short leap. Because one of the things about the Steadicam that makes it so perfect in that regard is its weightlessness, but that also makes it so difficult to operate because it takes such sensitivity.
Whereas Garrett Brown first told me it's going to be harder to learn than skateboarding and not as hard as playing the violin.
I mean, it's the first time I strap one on, I immediately was like, oh my God, I had no idea how hard this was. Now imagine that it's an arm that separates out from your body, but the camera is not only doing the pan and tilt and up and down, but actually can stabilize the Z-axis, which really shouldn't be that difficult from a motor standpoint. And then all of a sudden, you have a fully operational Steadicam without having to balance it. Without a gimbal for $5,000.
Yeah. The removing of the gimbal, you know, that's huge because that's not just one axis when you think about it. That's a lot more.
That's where your spine has to remain in perfect orientation, well, like Fred and Ginger.
What you got to be able to do is you've got to be able to figure out how to shift your weight properly against it at all times.
Yeah.
The thing isn't holding it up. It's leaning away from it.
My two cameramen, Scott and Benny, last year went and took a 10-day course with Garrett.
I was lucky enough to take that course in the 80s when it was still being run by Garrett and Ted Churchill, the late, late great Ted Churchill, who both personally taught me.
Amazing.
And Garrett always beat me up for being too confident. It's like I had to do the final exam twice. He said, you know what? I think you were just a little too cocky. Do it again.
Of course, I remember him from the Molson Golden ads.
Of course, where I think he made probably more money than he did on the Steadicam.
Well, I think he said that allowed him to invest in the invention and make it something.
It's funny in the background stuff for The Shining. You know, they went 6 months over on production,
right.
And Garrett had only committed to 6 months because then he had to go shoot Rocky II.
Right,
and so they flew him back and forth on the Concorde every weekend.
Oh my God!
For like 6 months, they flew him back and forth on the SST, back and forth to London.
Did you ever fly the Concorde?
Never did. I've been in one, but I've never flown in it. Did you?
No.
Yeah.
No.
I would. They say it was horrible. I've talked to people who did it.
Oh, really?
It was just like horrible. I know a guy that flew it a lot for business. Said, oh, you just get on it and get drunk as soon as you could because the noise and the vibration and everything were just unbearable. The only thing good about it was fast.
Yeah.
That thing was fast.
3 hours, right?
Have you been in one?
No.
Tiny.
No way.
Tiny.
That's why there's...
windows are this big because the radiation would like cook your face off. Because
they're flying, what, 60,000 feet?
Yeah. Like, you know... SR-21 kind of, or SR-20, wow. Whatever it is, Blackbird kind of altitudes. But the inside of it, they've got one in New York on the,
aircraft.
Oh, okay. It's on the Intrepid. And you can go into it.
I didn't realize that.
It's like, it's tiny, tiny airplane. Absolutely minute on the inside. I wouldn't have been able to stay in that thing for a cross-Atlantic.
Amazing. Was it 3 hours from New York to?
It was like 3:20, yeah.
Amazing.
New York to Paris. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
That's fun. All right, that's it for this week's Alton Browncast. We actually went a little long. I think it was a whole lot worth it. It was worth it just to sit here in Adam's amazing man cave. This is the man cave of man caves.
You got to visit Bleak House, Guillermo's place in L.A.
Oh, I can only imagine.
It's a Victoria. It's 10 times this amount of space filled with this level of density. I'm not joking.
Wow.
It's crazy.
Well, come by my house. I've got some pots and pans. We'll see you guys next week. Hey, food fans, if you've got a weakness for funny food songs, large and unusual culinary demonstrations, and puppets, you might want to catch my live touring show, The Edible Inevitable Tour, which is coming to a town near you. Just go to www.altonbrowntour.com and click on shows to find out where you can catch the action.